I'm joined by local author Robin Quinn. Robin, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Your latest book is about a fascinating character, a man called Charles Deville Wells. Many people will possibly not have heard about him, but he'd be better known as the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. The song, of course, is how people have heard of him, I expect. Is that the same of you? How did you hear about him?
Quite a long time ago, I was researching something completely different, and I spotted in a newspaper an article that said, "Man who broke bank at Monte Carlo has died." And I hadn't quite realised that there really was a man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo, although I was aware of a song about that. And I made a note to look at this a bit later on and got on with some other projects. And then I was looking for a theme for a second book, and started to research Charles Wells and found out that he really had gone to Monte Carlo. He had broken the bank and he'd won a very large sum of money. And he also had a very interesting life, because prior to going to Monte Carlo, he'd been an inventor and he'd done extremely well with that. But for some reason, he went off the rails and went in for a life of crime.
So he was a fascinating character. But the initial idea or the initial interest was the song. Because the song itself is quite interesting, isn't it?
Yes. Well, just after Charles Wells won at Monte Carlo all this money, a man called Fred Gilbert, who was a songwriter, was walking along the Strand one day and he saw one of these placards next to a newspaper seller saying, "Man who broke bank at Monte Carlo." And he rather thought it had got the rhythm and the sort of structure to make a song out
yes,
of it.
Yes, it bounces along, doesn't it, as a phrase.
Yes, he wrote a song bringing in phrases and words which he thought gave a good French atmosphere to the whole thing. And then he started looking for somebody to buy the song from him to perform in the music hall. He tried a couple of very well-known figures. They didn't really like the song. They didn't want to do it. He tried a third one he'd worked with before, who was a man called Charles Coburn. And Coburn considered the song, but he thought that these references to Paris and the Bois de Boulogne and all those sorts of things were a little bit above the sphere that his audiences in the music hall would appreciate. And he rejected the song and went back home. And then overnight, he found that the rhythm and the words and everything about the song was sort of coming back into his mind all the time. And he kept repeating it to himself, and he realised that there really was a lot of potential in it.
It is a very jaunty musical song. It's a very old song, isn't it? It's 1891.
Yes, it was composed then. That was the year when Charles Wells had actually broken the bank at Monte Carlo, so really within weeks.
Really?
And it was a topical song.
So obviously it was a big hit with the audiences in those days. They could all, you can imagine them all singing along to it. Should we hear the song?
Let's do that.
Okay.
As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, you can hear the girls declare, "He must be a millionaire." You can hear them sigh and wish that I would see them wink to the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, you can hear the girls declare, "He must be a millionaire." You can hear them sigh and wish that I would see them wink to the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo.
So that's great, isn't it, Robin? Simple song, but very catchy.
Yes,
and I'll be singing it all day now to myself.
I know. It was a favourite for many, many years, and really up to the end of the music hall era, which was sort of the late 1940s, early 1950s. You'd quite expect to hear that in a music hall. And, of course, you still heard it on the BBC now and again on
yes,
the Request
Yes, I heard it last week on Radio 2.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah. So, OK, let's talk about the man himself then. Charles Deville Wells. He was a real character. Was he just a chancer? Because he became a notorious criminal, right?
Certainly yeah? did.
Where did you start to investigate all of this? I mean, this is a very well-researched book. Did it become a labour of love? Was it an onerous task?
It was never onerous, because every time I did a bit of research or followed something up or one thing led to another, there'd always be something absolutely fascinating and completely unexpected. I mean, just to give you one example of that, he went in league with another man in some sort of fraud. And the other man was a vicar who, believe it or not, had served a prison sentence for fraud already. And the two of them together managed to defraud a large number of people of money for a particular scheme. They both went to prison. And all of the people that he had any dealings with, they all seemed to be a little bit sort of shady.
Charles Deville Wells convinced people to invest in him, didn't he?
He did, yes. He must have been very persuasive in some way. I think perhaps it was because he himself was not a, it didn't appear to be an extrovert. He came across as rather a shy man. And I think perhaps that encouraged people to say, oh, he seems very ordinary, he seems very straight, everything is safe, we'll leave our money with him. And he says he can multiply our money tenfold. Well, it's great.
Yeah.
And of course, nobody got a penny back with any of these schemes.
And you say he was an inventor. Did he invent anything that we would be familiar with today?
Well, one of the things, you know, when you get a packet and there's a little tab and you pull that tab and you tear along the dotted line and it opens up the packet. He invented that.
Good grief, did he?
He patented it back in the 1890s, I think it was, perhaps even the 1880s. Whether he actually put it into production or not, I really don't know. I suspect it came along a bit later.
Mm.
He had the idea also of putting mustard in tubes so that you could squeeze it out instead of having to have this thing with a silly little spoon and everything.
Yeah.
Now, again, nothing became of it, but he had had the idea and patented it first. And it was a well-known firm making mustard in this country that everybody knows that brought it out. Brought it out in 1935, eventually, long after he died.
That's amazing. We could talk at length, but we have to move along, and we need to talk about Monte Carlo. Did he have any money, or did he borrow money to go to Monte Carlo to try and win more money?
He'd got money from a lot of victims of his fraudulent ideas. So he was saying, if you put £30 or £300 into this, you'll get your money back 10 times over. When I get the patent on this machine or this gadget, you'll have a share in that. And of course, nobody, or hardly anybody, got a penny out of it. So at the time, he had got quite a lot of money. He took initially, I think it was £4,000 with him.
A considerable sum.
£400,000 in today's values, at least.
Yes.
At least, probably quite a lot more, really. And he used that as the stake money. And on that first trip, I think he multiplied the money that he had tenfold. So we're now coming back to £4 million in today's currency.
So he walked through the doors of the Monte Carlo Casino. An ordinary-looking gentleman.
Very ordinary.
They allowed him to sit at... Which table did he play? What was his game?
Mainly roulette, but there were only two games you could play in those days. The other one is called Trente et Quarante, and that is a card game. So after playing roulette, he then went on to the Trente et Quarante tables, and he had some successes there as well.
And he was successful. He made a lot of money on that. And did he literally... They say he broke the bank. Is that just a phrase? He didn't literally clean them out of all their cash? No.
It would be almost impossible. It would be like cleaning out the Bank of England or something. You just couldn't do it.
Mm.
What it actually meant was you would play, the table would pay out if you kept on winning, and if it ran out of money, it was said that the bank had been broken.
Mm.
There was a bit of a ceremony, and it really was only done for show. When the bank had been broken, they put a black cloth as a sort of symbol that it was closed, and people would just sort of filter away. The staff would come in with some more money, stock up, ready to go again. After about 5 or 10 minutes, they'd remove the cloth again. Everybody could come back to that table. So you've got this publicity thing, because if anybody there was sending news back to Britain, reporters or just private people, so that the word would get around as a rumour. They could say, oh yes, the bank was broken, we saw a man break the bank there. Mm. Didn't really mean an awful lot, but by having that ceremony, it did mean a lot more.
So he, after his first visit, he walked away with about £4 million.
In today's money. Yeah.
And he went back, he did it again a few times.
He went back in November, and that time he came away with the equivalent of another £2 million, so it was £6 million in all.
So what was his secret? Did he have a system? I mean, you've written in the book, Robin, we don't want to give a spoiler. We want people to read your book. So without giving too much away, did you discover if he had a system?
I think he'd got a staking plan, which isn't quite the same as an infallible system. I think he knew how to manipulate things, and that he had a very orderly mind because he was an engineer who designed steam engines and complicated things like that. And we talk about these things with mustard, and one of his other inventions was a musical skipping rope. These things all seem a little bit sort of not very serious, really. But he was a bona fide engineer, self-taught, but a very clever man.
So maybe he just had a methodical approach to, or he followed trends, perhaps. Because roulette is literally a chance, unless you've got some mechanical device that's going to persuade the ball to drop into a certain slot each time. I can't imagine, unless he had someone working for him on the other side, how he could have done it.
Well, this idea of interfering with the roulette wheel, somebody had apparently worked out that there could be inconsistencies in the wheel, and they'd taken notes over many weeks, and they saw that, say, the particular number came up quite often, so they'd bet on that number. But this had all happened 10 years previous to Charles Wells going there, and I think the casino would have been very alert to that sort of thing. We do know from a slightly later period that the roulette wheels were all tested every day for that sort of thing, and they could just swap them for a good one if there was any inconsistency. So I don't really think it was that. I think he knew how to bet in a consistent way, which helped him quite a lot. He always said that he had an infallible system, and of course he wouldn't say what it was.
Did he become famous in his own lifetime, or at the time when he was doing this, was he a famous person?
Yes, particularly when that song came out, and he was in the headlines of the newspapers and was very well known, and he was well known for the rest of his life as Monte Carlo Wells in the press.
So what happened to him after eventually stopped going to Monte Carlo, or did they stop him? Did they not allow him through the door when he arrived?
Yes, he went back a little bit later in the early part of 1892. He didn't do very well, and I think there was some friction between him and the casino. It's impossible to say exactly what. The casino either doesn't have the information or is reluctant to discuss it. And Wells didn't leave any real written legacy, a few bits and pieces, but nothing about how he gambled or anything like that.
So do we know what happened to him? Did he prosper from all this money that he'd made? Did people get their money back? Did it just disappear? And what happened to him in the end?
With all his different schemes, the biggest of which was in France when he set up a Ponzi scheme, exactly like the one that Charles Ponzi did 10 years later, which looks as if it was probably an imitation of what Wells did. That was the largest thing. That was in France, and he got hold of a very, very large sum of money with that. But he finished up going to prison. He lost all his money. He finished up in near poverty and was living with a family as a boarder when he died in the early 1920s.
Sad end.
And they didn't even know who he was. They hadn't even realised, the people he was staying with hadn't even realised that he was Monte Carlo Wells, because he'd sort of kept out of the limelight by that time.
Did he die in this country then, Robin?
In Britain, yes.
So where is he buried? Do we know where he ended up?
Yes, I've been to where he was buried. He's buried in North Sheen Cemetery, which is actually quite near to the National Archives, so I was able to kill two birds with one stone.
That's And is it obvious who he is from his headstone?
Not in the slightest. There's just a little sort of undulation in the ground where he is buried. Mm. There isn't any marker at all.
You'd want a roulette wheel, wouldn't you, really, something?
That would have suited him very well.
Wouldn't it? It's a fascinating story. Well done on the book. It's as I say, very well researched. There's a lot of information and a lot of facts. A lot more than we've got time to talk about today. So definitely well worth a read. Where is it available? I know it's hardback. It has been hardback for a little while. It's now paperback.
Paperback, as well.
So yes. Tell us how we can get it.
I think Waterstones have got it in most of their branches, and it is just generally available in bookshops and on the usual online sources.
And the book is entitled?
The Man Who Broke the Bank at Monte Carlo.
Excellent. So, well, congratulations once again. Well done on the book. Fascinating read. And thanks for your time today, Robin Quinn. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.